guest on the line. We're going to get into it. He's Richard Hill, who is a Auckland City Councillor. And you know what? I want to have a bit of a kōrero before I get Richard in. On the line, I want to talk about council funding because it's really important. We all pay our rates, even if we pay rent. Part of that goes towards our rates. And what I want to have a kōrero with Richard tonight is how do councils pay for the roads and water and our other services we need without crushing people under unaffordable rate bills? Labor thought they had the solution, and it was to take paying for water off the council's hands, but this new government has scrapped that and has put the bill back on the councils to pay. The reality is that, Tefano, we can't go on keeping we can't keep on neglecting our infrastructure, and the government can't keep loading more costs on the councils without giving them more ways to pay for them. So where is the money going to come from? Auckland Council is asking to keep GST on rates that currently go into the central government coffers. Is that a way forward? And that's the first question I'm going to ask Auckland City Councillor Richard Hill. Kia ora, Richard.
Tēnā koe, Shane, and kia ora koutou katoa to everyone who's listening.
Richard, where's the money going to come from?
The money for our long-term plan?
Yes.
At this stage, we're consulting on three different options, so a central proposal, a lesser proposal, and a more. We don't have many options. It's got to come from rates, and the mayor has a proposal about a future fund as well, which is about leasing out the port and potentially putting that into a fund to earn dividends that way. But of course, about 60% of our revenue now is not from rates, but we saw through COVID a bunch of that income dropped away. So, you know, from our stadiums, from our public transport, from the port and the airport, those things dropped away. So we were suddenly reliant on rates, or we had to have some big cuts, which did happen in the last few years.
So, Richard, let's put that on hold. I want to have a talk about you, and then we'll talk about the issues of the day. We've got plenty of time to have a kōrero. Richard, you're now in your second term. You're from the left. You held your seat against the swing that, by the way, we saw carrying on to the general election last year. Richard, so just tell us a bit about your whakapapa, a little bit about your background, and then we'll get into the issues of the day.
Yeah, kia ora. Ko Whangaroa Te Moana, ko Taratara Te Maunga, ko Ngāpuhi Tuku Iwi, ko Ngāti Kahu Te Whangaroa, Te Iwi, no Glenfield ahau, hika kona hira o Tāmaki Makaurau. So my very quick whakapapa, my mum is Pākehā from the North Shore. Her parents came over from England in the 50s on a ship for a better life after the war. And then my dad's side of the family, I think my nana and granddad, they've lived in Kaiōr or Whangaroa. They were farmers. My dad moved to Auckland when he was like 18, 19, didn't want to be a farmer. So left the farm to come to Auckland. And before that, so her grandmother was Miri Tihana. That's as far back I know, my whakapapa Rogers. And then her husband was Thomas, who came, that there's stories, but no one knows exactly how, but apparently when he jumped on a ship when he was about 12 years old and ended up jumping off that ship in Russell somewhere and then ended up meeting my great-great-grandmother in Kaiōr there. She had 13 kids, and the youngest was my great-grandmother, who had my nana. And yeah, that is the side of things. So I live in Glenfield with my husband and our little boy, Theodore Atafai. He's 2 and a bit years old.
So Richard, we all connect to our whakapapa in different ways, shape and form. Some people, you know, they're born into it. They're very connected to their marae. Were you aware of your whakapapa and your connection, or did that come in a little bit later in life?
Yeah, it came quite a lot later. So, I mean, my dad obviously spoke about it, but as far as I can see, my auntie's been doing all the cool family tree stuff.
Yes.
She's a JP, she was a deputy principal up at Kyle Primary till not that long ago. So she's retired now and doing all the whakapapa looking back. So I've heard stories, I've seen some pictures and things, but I think, as far as I know, Mere Tehana, she was really immersed in tikanga and was only full, te reo speaker. And then she taught all her 13 kids not to speak te reo because everyone was told to speak English then, I guess. And then, unfortunately, a lot of those stories and a lot of that was lost. So looking to figure out how to pick it all up. Now, thankfully, my auntie is gathering a lot of, she also volunteers at the Kyle Museum, so she's able to gather a lot of different information about our family. So, I do feel a real spiritual connection to Māori culture and that, but I don't have a lot of understanding of those links yet, but I'm definitely keen to learn more.
Richard, you're still, in terms of the council, you'll be amongst the younger sort of cohort, although there are a few younger sort of people in the Auckland City Council as councillors, but you got into politics quite young, particularly in terms of local body politics. What sort of drove you to politics and in particular local body politics?
Yeah, I think it was probably that exact reason. I looked around community at things I was frustrated about and saw that mostly it was older retired people who were stepping into these roles, and I figured there should be other voices. I was working for the health district health board across Auckland at the time, doing youth work, and saw a lot of things that could change and could be better. Thinking about climate change, public transport, all those sorts of things that I felt like the older generation, maybe not all of them, but some of them with old ideas, weren't focusing on the things that I thought were important for the city. So. I didn't exactly plan to come this way. I did stand for Labour in 2014 in Northcote. Didn't win, obviously. And then in 2016 stood for... So this is my third term on the council. 2016, George Wood stepped down very last minute, so I put my hat in the ring about 24 hours before the nominations closed and ran a really hard campaign and then won by about 120 votes, so pretty close.
You ran it against the swing, didn't you? And how did against the swing? Richard, let's get into the politics of the day. This is an iwi radio station. The government is signalling that if you were a council that brought on board Māori constituencies, you have to put it to the people. We haven't had that in Tamaki Makaurau because the Super City Act was slightly different. Where do you stand on this position, and how should that decision, if it was simply yours alone, how should that decision be made? So where do you stand on the issue, and how should the decision be made?
Yeah, so we around the council, we voted for Māori wards to be installed, but we lost that vote, 11 votes to 9, unfortunately, and that was only just the end of last year. So we had the strange thing is that, we're seeing this very disappointing and often racist rhetoric out there at the moment. I think last term when we voted, because we spoke to Minister Mahuta at the time, we needed a law change. Auckland Council was different than every other council, and we needed a separate law because of the Super City Law to enact or bring in Māori wards or Māori seats. So that was being done. And when we did that last term, I think it was almost unanimous. In this term, it's extremely divided, which is obviously disappointing. There are different ways and means. It's not as easy as other districts. I think we might end up with one Māori ward in the... There's two different systems that it could be, but unfortunately with the government change, that didn't end up coming through. And of course now the council holds a position against implementing it by a majority. But I think it is a real shame working with, I know I've been on the Young Elected Members and Local Government of New Zealand over the last, two terms, and right across the country, councils have been embracing it, and an overwhelming majority now, I think, have Māori seats and hasn't been an issue. And if the government does force those referendums, basically for no need, and everything seems to be going fine. I haven't heard a negative, thing about Māori seats being implemented, that actually these are going to be really expensive for those councils to do, and also pointless, but also will raise a lot of racism and misinformation, no doubt, in the communities when it's really unneeded.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, at the moment, Richard, we have the Independent Māori Statutory Board, which I think functions very well. They sit on committees, but don't sit on the council and have a vote. I think it works quite well, but I do get a little frustrated that I can't participate in the choosing of the directly. I can't participate in the choosing of our representatives, and that's not saying anything against the representatives, but I wouldn't mind a say through the ballot box. Richard, we've almost got a crisis throughout Aotearoa and New Zealand when it comes to infrastructure, and we often see what's happening on top of the whenua. Those sort of issues, but we don't have to dig very deep. And then we know we've got particularly sewage issues. Our beaches are closed, it seems to me, more and more often, Richard. Many of our rivers are not swimmable. I think we've got a new measurement. We say as long as they're wadeable, which I just think is crazy. But we've got a real real infrastructure deficit, Richard. And, you know, we're to blame. I'm talking about the voters, and I also would put it to you that perhaps our elected officials are to blame, because they really just sort of kicked the can down the track. What is our long-term solution in terms of investment in infrastructure, Richard?
Yeah, so infrastructure, I mean, in general, Auckland, in my perspective, the last two terms at least, we've really been trying to. I mean, since I've been on the council, I think we went from about $4 billion a year in water infrastructure to our last long-term plan, which was $11.2 billion. So, you know, doubled in transport and a number of other things. But our issue is the laws that require us, our debt-to-revenue ratios,
yes.
And the fact that at the moment, Watercare has to increase rates really quickly because their debt to revenue is on our books, and they're up to about, our normal debt to revenue is 2.9 times our debt can be 2.9 times our revenue, whereas Watercare's can be about 3.5.
Yes.
But that affects us. It is confusing for, there's a lot of other stuff behind it. But essentially, we are paying cash for pipes that will be under the ground for 50, 60, 70 years instead of borrowing, which, you know, people don't like borrowing, but if you're borrowing for assets that are lasting for a long time and you can pay them off in it, then you can do more. And the issue with what the Three Waters was going to do would have kept that off our balance sheet, which meant Watercare could do a lot more quicker. So I will say we were catching up, you know, Central Interceptor, one of the biggest projects after the City Rail Link. Phil Gough added the water quality targeted rate, which was like a significant increase in funding all sorts of different projects, which is great, but we're so far behind. We are, you know, a lot of our pipes are 80, 90 years old, and we are backfilling them. You know, councils in the past, I know Auckland City Council, you know, pushed out their depreciation by 80 years for pipes, and now we're paying for that sort of issue now. So, you know, on the North Shore, we separated in the 90s, which helped a lot, but there is still, you know, many issues right across the system that, you know, we're trying to get on top of, but without, I think Watercare is looking at a 26% increase in water rates this year because we didn't get that balance sheet separation, which means that they're having to cash fund a lot more of the assets instead of borrow over long term.
Richard, do you think you would be able to hold rates to inflation or thereabouts?
Yeah, so there's three options. I can't remember this. The third, the middle option is about 7.7, so that is already above inflation.
Yep.
But that is, you know, a lot of us are looking to, the regional fuel tax has been taken off us. It's $1.2 billion plus all the borrowing capacity of that, which is another $400 million a year on top. So that, you know, we're still looking at about a 7.7 rates rise, but it will mean we have to then cut back on infrastructure. Or we could put, there's another option of going up to 14% rates rise, which would be able to do a lot more faster, but is that too hard for people right now when they're already facing everything else go up? So the fact that the waters, Three Waters issue and the regional fuel tax has been taken from it, you know, that's obviously going to feel good in people's pockets today. But as we've already seen with the government announcements,
that's right.
It just popped up somewhere else.
Someone has to pay for it, and it's normally the rate or the taxpayer. Hey, I've got my good friend Jamie Daly in the studio with me. He's very keen on housing issues and planning issues, and he's got a question in relation to planning. He lives and operates out of South Auckland, so very different living perspective to the one that I have. And you have Richard. Kia ora, Jamie.
Kia ora, Richard. I just wanted to put a question to you around the housing and our NDRS residential standards. Just in terms of where it's sitting at the moment, can you just sort of enlighten the listeners on where we're sort of trending, and also just some feedback on the policy around New Zealand First cutting red tape for granny flats to be built, and just your thoughts on that general policy?
Yeah, so I haven't heard the exact details about the granny flat one, but I think we do have some good policy on that already, but I'm happy to look further. You know, if council can make that easier, then that would be a good thing. On the MDRS and the MPSUD, so we council supported the MPSUD, but council by majority didn't support the MDRS. The issue, and we've written to the mayor is keen to pull out some of that MDRS now that it's been given to us as an option, but we've had no reply for couple of months now from the government, because at the moment we're actually in the Plan Change 78 process already, which is essentially the plan change which enables all the upzoning. So we're looking to obviously keep all the walkable catchments, which means six stories or more around stations and metropolitan centres, town centres. But the MDRS was sort of a blanket approach, which lots of people support, but some people think, you know, do we need three story by three out on the coast or up north, or is it more important to keep that nearer things and infrastructure that we already have? And so we're looking to see, you know, the law we can't change, so we have to continue this plan change process. And when the hearings start, it's about up to $500,000 a week that we have to, you know, this is a government process, but ratepayers will be paying for the process. If councillors, including the mayor, want to stop that process, we have to go through the whole plan change and then start again, or the government can give us dispensation to add a few things. We need to add the light rail route, because that was held back. Not that I agreed with that, I actually voted against that because I thought we should have added it in regardless, but we are where we are. That's held back, but because the government's cancelled light rail, now we've got a whole corridor that's not being upzoned, but we can't legally put that in unless the government changed the law. And same with the hazards. So there's three different things that we want to put into this new plan change, and rightly or wrongly, the government is giving councils the option to remove the MDRS. But the thing is, and I've made everyone aware of this, including councillors, we can't just remove the MDRS, which is that three stories, you know, three houses, three stories, every property, if you want to do that. You have to add the capacity somewhere else, and so that is not going to be as simple as I think a lot of people think. Oh, stroke of a pen, we'll just remove that. It's all linked, and the government law doesn't allow us to change that unless they change the law. So I think there's a lot of promises that have been told to people that are not as simple as just a stroke of a pen, I guess.
Jamie's got a follow-up, Richard.
Just in terms of the Plan Change 78, can you just sort of broadly sort of elaborate in terms of what that means for urban Māori people? Like, obviously, my general understanding, broadly speaking, is that it allows for greater intensification, say, within 1 kilometre of public transport, be it a main train station. Can you just sort of, I guess, articulate as best as you can, like, the key points within Plan Change Proposed 78?
Yeah, sure. So Plan Change 78 is the instrument that enables the MPSUD, and that's the National Policy Statement for Urban Development, which is for all cities across the country. And then the MDRS came a bit later. That was the National Labour Joint Bill, and that's Medium Density Residential Standards. I'll talk about them as one because the plan change actually makes it one, which is why it's hard to pick it apart if people want to do that. But yeah, essentially it does give, the unitary plan did give quite good upzoning. We are different to the rest of the country and have seen a lot of intensification since the unitary plan. But what this does is puts it on heat, essentially. So there's significant increase in upzoning or height enabled around the city centre, and I think it's 1,200 metres or 1,500 metres, sorry, I can't remember off the top of my head, from the city centre that you can have six stories or more. And then around our, it's about 800 metres from metropolitan centres, places like Monaco, New Lynn, Takapuna, Albany, places like that. And then it's, I think, 800 as well from all train stations and all bus stations. So it won't be from all bus stops, but it's from the really busy stations. And that's in a circle. So if you can walk, I think it's a, between 800 and 1,000 metres, the council's got to choose what their walkable catchments were. And it's roughly that. You can basically, as of right, have six stories or more. That means you'll still have to have consent for a number of things, but you won't. Basically, it gives developers or people who own land in those areas the ability to build very easily or easier up to six stories, which the bones of it are good. Some of it, you know, it's hard where we don't have the infrastructure yet. But if you're thinking of getting people, like all around the world, to be able to walk, cycle, catch buses to the train stations, it's really good. And
yeah,
it's
and it makes sense. Richard, one of the problems with Tamaki Makaurau, we're a very spread out city. You know, we 1.2 million people, which is a lot of people, but, you know, from Pukekohe to Albany, that's a heck of a long way. And then you've got the Waitakere's to beyond the isthmus. We really do have to look at mid-density housing, shared facilities, shared green facilities. We really do have to have a... Have a different look in terms of the paradigm. The days of the quarter acre section have been over for some time, but we that's just the reality of the modern world we live in.
Yes, absolutely. That is, and that's the way that Auckland was going since unitary plan. So the overwhelming majority of our consents, thankfully, are now within the urban areas. I led the future. What's it called? Can't even remember the name now. It was end of last year. It felt like ever, but a change to our planning, essentially, we pulled back in a lot of greenfield areas, especially if there was flooding. Obviously, we got a lot of pushback from developers, but we do need, we don't have the money for that infrastructure way out in the middle of nowhere. And we also don't want to be continually building houses in floodplains like we have been for decades. So we pulled back on some of that. And in the end, we got good support around the table. It was almost a full unanimous decision on the future development strategy for Auckland. So that was through my committee, the Planning, Environment and Park Committee. So that will help enable, you know, there still will be greenfield. There's live zoned land everywhere, Drury, other places like that. But we are trying to pull back and encourage more intensification, which will be ramped up with this new MPSUD as well.
Look, we've got about 7 or 8 minutes, so I'm going to do some quite quick-fire sort of subjects. Richard, why is it easier to have higher-density housing in West Auckland, South Auckland, than it is in Epsom, where I live, or the North Shore, where you live?
Yeah, so there's places on the North Shore and Epsom where it is the same ease. I guess, you know, in Northcote and Birkenhead, Glenfield, there's significant, huge developments happening there. But in West, maybe, I guess, developers bought land cheaper than North. And then you've got special character areas, say, in Devonport, Northcote Point, places in Epsom, maybe, I'm not sure, but around Ponsonby. You've got these big areas which have always been character or heritage areas, which don't enable the same amount of zoning. But there are areas across, you know, Northcote.
Did you have that issue? You had that issue in Totara Park, didn't you?
That's right. And Hill Park comes under it. Historical.
Just moving on to other issues, Richard. As we do have limited time, and I really appreciate you being on the line for us. Just a micro issue, but an issue that's been really important for people that have been fighting for the last 30 or 40 years. I'm really, really pleased to see that the people of Te Aratu are going to get their marae, Richard.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic news. So I think Shane Henderson was pretty proud to share that news. And I know the local board there have spent many years working with the community on this, and I've not heard, you know, there was apparently, which I've not heard myself, you know, negative connotations of, you know, back and forth with community back in the day on this, but apparently this has been really well received, and it's really exciting for Te Aratu, and hopefully that we can see that, you know, spades in the ground and happening really soon, because I think much like the community on the shore there, there is a lack of spaces for mana whenua and mātāwaka to share time and tangihana and culture events and everything. And so this will be huge for the West Auckland community.
See, Richard, I put it to you that the dynamic changed, particularly over COVID, because as we know, we had problems with immunisation rollout, and then the resources were put into the urban marae. You know, I think it would have been a very different scene if Papakura marae, Manirewa marae, here at Ngā Whare Wātea, Hone Waititi marae, Waipareira Trust. And I just think that the dynamic has changed, and that you've got those marae not only catering for mana whenua, people like me from the urban environment, but you come to Ngā Whare Wātea a week leading up to Christmas, and they're doing their food drives. There's Māori, there's Pākehā, there's all sorts of people in need without any questions answered. Do you think that sort of lived experience has changed people's perspective, Richard?
Yeah, I think so. I'd hope so. That's why it's so confusing and disappointing to see the change from government. A lot of the immersion of Māori and Te Reo Māori through government departments was, 2016, the Māori Language Act, this under John Key and Peter Sharples, and, this isn't just some sort of left-right thing. It's a shame that the community, I think, has changed in such a positive way. On the shore here, we had the biggest kapa haka festivals. Yeah. We never used to have that when I was a kid here. Both Beachhaven and Glenfield, all the schools come together. There's huge celebrations for Matariki. We're up Takarunga on the first Matariki with thousands of people.
Yeah, I don't think it's our Tamariki that have the problem, eh, Richard? Maybe some of the older sort of cohort that have the problem. Richard, the relationship between the councillors and the mayor, particularly early on, seemed a little bit fractured, but it seems that he's managed to build working relationships across the left and the right, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, I decided from day one that I would work with him. Same with the previous mayor, Phil Goff. In my opinion, you don't have to agree with him, but if you want to get things done and you want to understand how the council's working, you've got to be working with the mayor and his office, because there's in Auckland, it's such huge power behind the mayor and the office. So I did my best to work with him. I can talk, I can tell him off when I think he said something that I don't agree with, and we agree to disagree on a number of things. So I think over time he's realised some of the councillors maybe he thought were his backers at the early stages are maybe ones that aren't doing a lot of work or aren't that interested in moving the city forward, and he's figured out some of us on more progressive side are keen, maybe not in the same ways always as he does, but are keen to see the city move forward and keen to see new ideas. So he has, he's trying his best, I think. He does slip up every now and again, like we all do, but I think the key for those of us trying hard to work with him and understand his point of view, know the city, they voted for us and they voted for him, so Aucklanders expect us to work together. So,
Richard, tell us about a particular local project that you're very keen on advancing, because at the end of the day you're voted in by a local constituency to represent them on the border interest. But yeah, just tell us about a local project that perhaps our listeners don't know about that you're quite proud of, or something that you want to move along.
Yeah, so a very short one. I've got two. I'll be quick. The local community hall in Marlborough Park when I was a kid was basically falling apart. I worked hard to get that basically switched into a youth centre and heaps of cool upgrades and all that down there. That's one. And the other one is Te Ara Awataha, so down in Northcote, where we have seen thousands of new homes. We've got a new blue-green network through there. So what we did was work with Kāinga Ora, Eka Pūnuku, Mana Whenua, the Kaipāraki project, to basically rip out the pipes, rip out the roads, and put in what is a blue-green network, which during the floods we'd just opened with Mana Whenua 2 months before, and it didn't flood down there. So when
I was in the
state housing areas, basically, that place used to flood all the time. So what we did was build a big dry pond and then also just let the awa breathe and come back to life, and through it, we proved it worked. Sadly, we didn't think we'd have to prove it that soon, but those floods didn't flood the community down there, and it showed. So we're going to continue that and down in places like Torter Vale, Milford, Sunny Nook, where the, some of the worst flooding happened. Also out west in Mangere and Roskill, huge, you know, we're going to try to do that across the whole city. It's going to be expensive, but we're going to try and reduce that flooding and bring those awa back, because it's good for biodiversity, climate change, everything.
Absolutely.
When it's not flooding as well.